Hello and welcome to the Adults in Autistic podcast. In today's episode, I'm talking with Rachel, who is a scientist from the University of Bournemouth, and we discuss the link between self-harm and autism. So because of that, I'm putting a big fat trigger warning here. In this episode, we do discuss self-harm and not so great mental health issues, and it's just... I can't remember if things get graphic, but if just don't. I'm not being the reason that it triggers off anything in any of you. Maybe get someone else to listen to it for you first and then let you know if you'll be able to handle it. Or just, yeah, be careful. Sorry this episode is late as well. The world kind of, you know, Black Lives Matter, saying that here. I exist, I am black, and I matter, just to let you know that, because apparently some people don't. But yeah, just me and Rachel talking about her research, getting insight into what goes on in the autism research world, because a lot of it is, what's the phrase? Nothing about us without us. A lot of it is about us and is without us. And Rachel is actually autistic herself, and we learn about her diagnosis. I'm talking a lot. I'm just going to get into the episode. Thank you for being here. Links in the show notes as usual. And thank you to Rachel's guests, not guests, what do you call it? Research participants who, without them, none of this would have been possible. So have a great listen. Trigger warning, don't forget, self-harm if it's not for you, it's not for you. If you need any help in regard to mental health, give it a Google. Loads of resources out there. I am not a psychologist, nor can I help you. But there are people out there who can. So find them. Use them. They're there. Let's get into the episode.
I should start by just saying thank you so much for having me on here. And just introduce myself. Okay, so my name's Rachel and I'm a scientist and a lecturer working at Bournemouth University in the UK. And I identify as female. What else? About my diagnosis. So I was diagnosed when I was 28. So that would be about 4 years ago. So gosh, it feels like a long time ago now. Yeah, so I was diagnosed at the Lorna Wing Centre near London, and it was a wonderful thing, really. It allowed me to kind of understand.
So did you start research related to autism before your diagnosis or after?
I did. It's a funny story and it's kind of embarrassing. So I started research on autism long before I knew that I was on the spectrum myself. So I had this fascination with autism because I felt like I could really empathize with struggles fitting in and kind of understanding the social world. And I had no idea that I was on the spectrum myself. So when I went into studying autism and I did my PhD, and I later did a bit of work on girls and women on the spectrum, and I learned a lot more. And one day I said to my mum, well, you know, I'm studying such and such. And she said, oh, well, you were assessed. Psychologists thought you were on the spectrum when you were a child. And it turns out, a long story short, I remember being taken to see many psychologists and not knowing why at the time, but it was the kind of working diagnosis was that I was autistic, but I was passed over for assessment because at the age of 10 at that time I made eye contact, and of course you know that we autistic people don't make eye contact. So yes, once I'd found that out, that it was this kind of suspected diagnosis when I was a child, it made so many things make sense. And so I then went for an assessment. Yeah.
Okay. And how did you find the process as an adult? You never really experienced it as a child. I don't remember, but how did you find it?
Well, it was strange and difficult because I, being an autism researcher. I also had training in some of the diagnostic instruments like the ADOS and the ADI. So I know them inside out and I know how they work. So I was assessed at the Lorna Wing Centre and they use a different kind of diagnosis assessment. But even so, I kind of understood it as I was going through it. So it was a bit strange.
But yeah, you knew what they were trying to find out.
Yeah. But at the same time, I think the overarching thing was that it took away so much of the shame and the guilt and the feeling of wrongness. And that was wonderful.
So how have you found being a part of, are you really like involved? Obviously you do your research and stuff, but aside from that, are you involved in the autistic community in any other ways?
It's a hard question to answer. I suppose I'm not really aware of the full breadth of roles that people take in the community. I'm involved in so much as I attend a local support group and have friends there. I'm a member of a few online communities. So I guess that's
heavy involvement, I'd say.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So do you have any comorbidities along with your sort of diagnosis?
Yeah. So basically, I have a couple of fun things. So unfortunately, anxiety and depression tend to be a fairly bog standard thing for us. Yeah, eating disorder, these kind of fun things. It was very helpful for me to get my diagnosis because these are comorbidities that have always plagued me. And I always think about it like an iceberg. You know how an iceberg is really huge under the water and people keep seeing, people see the tips of the iceberg. So people in my life kind of looked at me and said, you know, it's one thing after another with you. You know, first it was the depression, then it was the anxiety, then it was the anorexia. But because we didn't know about the autism, we didn't see the iceberg under the water. We just saw the tips. So finding out about the autism, suddenly you saw the iceberg and it suddenly made complete sense why all of these other things had been happening.
So we're having a conversation today about your specific piece of research that you did relating to autism and self-harm. Mm. So I have had a read over the paper, a lot. Because it's quite scientific, as it would be being a journal. Why did you think that was a topic? No, I mean, don't be sorry. You've written for your audience. It's just not me. Made you want to research that topic?
Okay, I'll explain. So before I explain, I'll just quickly add, I am one of these people, I'm terrible at talking on the phone because I never can predict when people have finished speaking and when I should speak. So I do apologise if I get that wrong here as well. I'm sure you've heard about it, but in autism, in our community, there is such a problem with suicide. There's huge problems with mental health, really, generally, with anxiety and depression. And there's a really heightened rate of suicide. And so in the non-autistic population, there's a really strong relationship between self-injury and suicide. So strangely, though, we really don't know very much about self-injury within autistic people. So I wanted to really get a better picture of what self-injury looks like in autistic people, and also to understand a bit more whether
it looks like
kind of like what its features are. So kind of what behaviours people engage in and why, and kind of when it starts, how people feel about it. And I also wanted to kind of see about are there things that kind of predict whether or not someone self-injures? Does it have a relationship to suicide, how suicidal someone feels, for instance? So I kind of wanted to shine a light on all of those things.
And so how did you go about finding those things out?
Well, we did two studies, actually. So we looked for participants online, and some really, really generous people came forward. And we later went back and asked them if they might take part in a kind of second follow-up study. So basically what we did was we ended up with, I think it was 102 participants in the end, who were so kind to complete a number of online surveys for us. And what we asked them to do basically was they completed a very detailed questionnaire about self-injury. And across the two studies, they also completed a few questionnaires on different things, like we looked at kind of sensory issues, depression, anxiety. We looked at kind of feelings of suicidality, so whether people had ever attempted suicide or whether they felt suicidal. We also looked at something called alexithymia, which is a difficulty identifying how you're feeling and kind of communicating that to other people. So we looked at all of these things, and then we did some analyses to look at kind of to characterize what self-injury looks like, its features in autistic people. And then also to kind of look at relationships between self-injury and, for instance, sensory issues and the like.
Yeah. So what were you expecting to find out ahead of doing your research?
Yeah. So, well, there hasn't been much done on self-injury and autism. There was, at the time when I was writing this, there was one paper. It's a really good paper. It's by an author whose surname is Maddox, and I think it was published in 2017. And so these authors didn't really find many differences, for instance, in the reasons why autistic people hurt themselves, and they kind of found that they did similar kind of behaviours, and they started at the same age as non-autistic people. For similar reasons. So I was interested in kind of probing into that a bit deeper, but I was also expecting that some of the same kind of predictor variables would be useful. I basically kind of wanted to see, are there red flags that we can identify in the autistic community? Are there things that we can kind of recognize that might make a person especially vulnerable to self-injury? So I expected that if a person really struggled with sensory sensitivity, I expected that to perhaps predict self-injury. Likewise, alexithymia really has a strong role in self-injury in non-autistic people. Because it kind of, if you have a real difficulty with identifying how you're feeling and in communicating that to other people, it might well be that you find self-injuring, it's a way of communicating in many cases. So often people self-injure because they're really struggling with something and they just have no language to put that across. Self-injuring can send a very strong message. It can kind of send a message to other people. I can't cope. Please leave me alone. Please stop hurting me. Please help me. It can send all kinds of messages. It also can be a way of expressing how you're feeling when you just can't put that into words. And people also find that self-injuring kind of, it changes how they're feeling. It can be, people sometimes use it as a way of regulating their emotions. So again, with alexithymia, I expected that if you have this difficulty really identifying what you're feeling and also communicating it, then it might well be that you're more vulnerable to self-injuring because by self-harming, you find a way where it changes how you're feeling. And it also communicates that to other people which are things that you might have a special difficulty with because of your alexithymia? Can I go into any of that a bit more?
If you want, yeah, sure. What did you actually find in your studies?
Sure. So basically, I'm going to summarise two papers here because one of them's a little one and the other one's a kind of bigger one. What we found. So first thing we found was, well, we kind of replicated this previous study in that we found that autistic people, although we didn't have a comparison group of non-autistic people to compare with, we found that autistic people were quite similar to the literature in non-autistic people. So we found mostly that our autistic participants were, they would start self-injuring in adolescence. So they were like a roughly 15, which is what we normally see in non-autistic people as well. We found that they would kind of engage in the same kind of behaviours. So the most common behaviours in self-injuring participants were, just finding it, my paper, kind of scratching or pinching, cutting themselves, or maybe banging and hitting themselves, or kind of hitting other objects. So quite similar to non-autistic people. They would tend to be, again, targeting the same kind of areas of the body, so mainly the arms, the hands and the head. And they would tend to be doing it for similar reasons. So because they were angry with themselves or they were upset, and they would accidentally discover it. We also found that they engaged in self-injury for quite similar reasons as non-autistic people. So we found that most people, they would engage in self-injury for several reasons rather than just engaging in it for the same reason every time. So many people would do different behaviours for different reasons at different times. So the most common thing that we found was that people would hurt themselves for the purpose of kind of breaking through what we call low pressure emotions. So things like feeling depressed or feeling numb. We've found here that, like non-autistic people, our autistic participants would very often use self-injury as a kind of way of breaking through these emotions. They would also use self-injury as a means of calming down what we call high-pressure emotions. So things like being frustrated, being agitated or angry. We also found that they would use self-injuring for punishing themselves. So say, for instance, they were feeling self-hatred. It's very common in non-autistic people for people to hurt themselves, to kind of punish themselves. And so we saw that in our autistic group as well. And also that they would somewhat counterintuitively actually self-harm to prevent themselves from doing anything more dangerous. So one person phrased it in a wonderful way about getting out of the lost. So they found that by hurting themselves, they were actually able to kind of calm themselves down and prevent themselves from engaging in anything more dangerous. We also found people engaged in it for reasons of sensation seeking, because it would kind of give them a buzz. And finally, a few people said that they engaged in it to kind of communicate or express how they were feeling. And there's a lot of results, and I'm talking a lot. I've got some more results, but would you like to ask any, do you have any questions about any of those things?
My question that I have at the minute would be, given that there are so many similarities to the way that non-autistic people self-harm and the reasons for it, what did your research actually tell you? Like, what came from it? Because all you've done is find out what we already know
Yeah.
from what I'm hearing you say so far.
Well, basically, what we found out was that self-injury looks quite similar in autistic people as it does in non-autistic people. However, basically, the way we moved forward from, there had only been this one paper, this Maddox paper, that had a look at self-injury in autistic people without intellectual disability and kind of what that looked like. However, that paper didn't actually look at any of the predictors of self-injury in autistic people. So this is what I was saying before about wanting to be able to recognize what features might make a person especially vulnerable to self-harming. So we were interested in alexithymia, as I mentioned, and also in sensory issues. And we did find in our participants that if we wanted to predict within our group of self-harmers and non-self-harmers, if we wanted to predict who self-harmed, then alexithymia was a very good predictor. So basically, participants who self-harmed were much, much more likely to have high levels of alexithymia. And this is kind of in line with what we predicted, in that if you have problems with alexithymia, then self-injury you might well stumble across that and find it something that helps you in terms of communicating how you feel. And we also found that sensory sensitivity was something that, again, the more people experienced that, the greater likelihood was that they would self-harm. And we also moved the research on, because no one had really asked autistic people how they felt about self-injury. So this is the rest of the findings of the study. So I'll go on to that and kind of explain it. We wanted to understand, as I mentioned before, was there a relationship between self-injury and suicide? Part of understanding that was to talk to autistic people about how they felt about self-injury. We wanted to kind of understand how they thought about it, what it meant to them, and also any advice they'd give other people about it. And the kind of main findings we found, to summarise, we found this really interesting distinction between people who were really upset about their self-injury, and they talked about it as an addiction, something that showed how unwell they were. They didn't want to do it. But on the other hand, we found people who kind of framed it as a conscious choice, as something they would do in order to calm themselves down, to maintain this kind of state of balance. And these people actually said that it wasn't a problem for them in their lives. This was a really striking finding of our first paper, because to us, we wondered whether this meant maybe in autistic people who self-harm, some people really are not at greater risk of suicide. This is kind of striking, because in non-autistic people, self-injury is a really big red flag for later suicide. So this raised a really big question for us. So these people in our first study were saying, self-injury is not a big deal for me. It's almost a positive thing. So we really wondered from that, does how they feel about self-injury, does that actually relate to their suicide risk? Or maybe within the self-harming community, are there some people at greater risk of, are there features of self-injury that especially predict someone's suicide risk? So that is what we went back to find out in the second study. And to summarise very quickly what we found and what was really new about this was that I think the most striking thing we found was that in participants who self-injure, they are more likely to feel suicidal and to have attempted suicide. And what we found was that although there was this relationship between having self-harmed and having experience of suicide ideation or suicide attempts, there was no relationship between someone, how they felt about their self-injury and their suicide risk. So from this, it's a preliminary finding and we need to do more research. But what we found from this was that it suggests that no matter how someone feels about their self-injury, it's still worrying in terms of increasing their suicide risk. This is really interesting from a theoretical perspective because in non-autistic people, there's a very popular model, which a theory which tries to understand why people attempt suicide. And this theory suggests that self-injury gives someone, it makes them capable of suicidal behaviours. It suggests that self-injury kind of lowers our inhibitions. It makes us less afraid of pain, less afraid of death, essentially. And therefore, no matter why you self-injure and no matter how you feel about it, this theory suggests the basic fact that you do it increases your risk of being able to attempt suicide in future. So our preliminary findings actually support that interpretation in autistic people because we found that no matter how someone feels about their self-injury, just the fact that they do it is related to suicide risk and attempts.
So piecing together your two studies. Yeah, it did make sense, don't worry. So piecing together your two studies, could you then argue that having alexithymia makes you more likely to commit suicide? Is that too big of a leap to make?
It's a really intuitive link, and I think that you're probably right. We didn't test that statistically. We know in the non-autistic population that alexithymia is a big suicide risk. And the link you made, so we saw that alexithymia increases the likelihood that someone will be a self-harmer. It seems highly probable that it would also increase the risk of suicide in autistic people. We didn't test that statistically, but it's a very, very plausible hypothesis. And we kind of came away from our two studies saying alexithymia might be a really important thing for clinicians to actually identify in autistic people, because it's something that is a really big general risk factor for mental illness and for self-injury. And we know in the general population that it's highly related to suicide as well.
So moving forward from this study and these findings, what's the next step for your research? Like, where do you see it going in practice? And then where do you see it going for like you and your team and then further research?
Yeah, well, I guess there's a lot of things I still want to find out. I want to understand more about self-injury, about identifying red flags in people who self-harm. So a couple more findings that we had, because we wanted to kind of see what features of self-injury might be especially worrying. And we found out that things, a very preliminary analysis, and it wasn't very strong in terms of our methods. So a few things like just kind of statistical details. But we found, for instance, that cutting as a method seemed to be especially related to the risk of suicide. Also, using self-injury for particular reasons. So using it, I'm just scanning down to my results because there were so many I need to remember. Just scanning down. Using it for particular reasons. Da-da-da-da. Excuse me a minute. It was more related to using it for particular, where they were using it to regulate low energy states. So people who, basically I wanted to see whether people engage in self-injury for many different reasons, and are there particular types of self-injury for certain reasons that we should be more worried about. And the suggestion was that if people are using it to regulate these low energy states like depression or numbness, if they're using it for sensory stimulation and if they're using it to punish themselves, these seem to be especially associated with suicide. So in terms of where we want to take this, we really want to carry out a larger scale study with more participants and more stronger methods, really. One particular study I'm planning to do at the minute is really trying to look at the... In suicide research, we talk about the transition, ideation to action transition, about how a person can, what are the factors that lead someone to feel suicidal? And what are the factors that actually allow them to act on that feeling? And this study kind of fits in that gap there where self-injury, we believe, is something that makes it possible for a person to move from feeling suicidal to actually attempting suicide. And we just really want to delve into that more with stronger methods, look at kind of the details of self-injury. So what in more depth and in stronger methods, kind of looking at what is it about particular methods, if particular methods are especially dangerous, what about the frequency, what about kind of the number of behaviours, what is it about self-injury that might make a person move from feeling suicidal to actually attempting suicide? And are there other variables or other factors, like other things in a person's life that can make them move from feeling suicidal to actually attempting suicide? And those, I really just want to really delve into that transition in depth.
And what would the real world, not that obviously the research is real, but what would the practical real world outcomes of that be?
I think it's really around addressing the statistics in terms of suicide and autism are just so frightening and upsetting. I'm going to pull them up in front of me now so I can actually give them to you. But it's really upsetting that, and just really terrifying when you think about it, that autistic people without intellectual disability are on average dying 16 years earlier than non-autistic people. 16 years. Mm. That is, and one of the most common causes of death is suicide, and that is just mind-blowing. And what we're seeing is that the figures vary in terms of how much more common suicide is in autistic people, but there's some suggestion that autistic people are 9 times more likely to die of suicide, and that 66% of autistic adults report suicide ideation, and up to 35% report attempts. So there's just, it's just terrifying how common suicide ideation and attempts are in autism. And so in terms of the implications of this research, there's been so much research trying to understand why non-autistic people feel suicidal and what, why they attempt suicide, what makes it possible for them to do so. And so I think we just have hardly any understanding of suicide in autistic people. We don't know what are the things that make it so dangerous and so possible for people to attempt suicide. And where do we start to intervene? Where do we plug the gaps? Where do we start to give people the support they need? And so I really want to research where are the real danger zones, where are the red flags, so that we can then start to plug those gaps and put support measures in place.
Thank you for agreeing to be a guest today. We found out so much amazing stuff about your research, and I'm sure there'll be listeners who are autistic and want to help out and help you do more good work for the community. So how can they get involved?
That's so kind. And basically anyone who wants to email me and find out more about the work I'm doing or the studies I'm publishing can most certainly, if you just look for me on Google, you'll find my institutional page and you can email me. I'm not currently running any studies, but I really hope to be in the coming months. So you are more than welcome just to send me an email, find out what I'm doing. So I'm on a few Facebook groups, Autistic Not Weird and Autistic Autism Researchers. So you might see me around on there. But I'm very relaxed and easygoing. So please always, you can find all of my papers on my profile page at Bournemouth University, and just always feel free to get in touch with me.
I'll leave a link to your institutional page in the show notes so anyone who wants to find you and find out more about your research can head there. And yeah, thank you so much for being a guest today.
Thank
it's been amazing.
You.
I found out so much.
Thank you so much. And I wonder.
Thank you to Rachel and to everybody else who's been a guest in season one of the Adults and Autistic podcast. I think we've had some pretty good episodes, and this was an absolute banger. That is one on YouTube exclusively. That's between me and Aspergirl. Bibi. Oh, I always forget when I come to pronounce it. Hon, I'm so sorry if I just got your name wrong again. But we talk about a lot of things. She lives in not Antarctica, but like northern Canada in Nunavut, where it's just a really completely different way of life. And I learned a lot about how they live up there and how the challenges of living there also helping Hinda have an autistic life, and something you can learn too. So if you've not had enough out of this season, if you want to see a little bit more, then you have a full, I think it's about, it's split into two videos. I am rambling on a little bit, so find it, the Adults and Autistic podcast. It's on YouTube, on my YouTube channel, which is Autistic Tyler. Links to Rachel's Institute page will be in the show notes below, like I said, and you'll be able to find all her research and stuff there. I'm going to take a planned break now whilst I reach out to some new guests for season two, sort out the format, sort out the audio, you know, just sort out a lot of things. But thank you for joining me so far. It does mean a lot.